Kia ora, welcome to Fighting for Your Mind. I'm Mary Jane, and today I'm interviewing author Alan Duff on his latest book, Conversation with My Country. Kia ora, Alan.
Kia ora.
So, what inspired you to write your latest book, Conversation with My Country?
When I realised I had been having a conversation with my country, literally, I was lying in the bath trying to think up a title. And once I thought of the title, that informed the entire narrative, because I've been having the conversation, obviously, through my books, the movies, and my newspaper columns, and television documentaries as well.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So what was the objective? What is it that you hope to achieve, or if anything, in the writing of this book? Is it just something you felt like you needed to do, or it was...
No, I was actually asked by the business group New Zealand Institute to write it. They commissioned me to write it.
Yes.
They asked me to write a book based on a book written called Hillbilly Elegy, about the guy growing up with...
Yeah, J.D. Vance.
J.D. Vance, yeah. And... And I said, no, I'm not copying anybody else.
Yeah.
But it did occur to me I could.
You read it?
I read it three times. And then it did occur to me that I could write about my own kind of hillbilly life.
Yeah.
So to speak, you know. Yeah. As well, inform people that I came from a highly educated Pākehā family.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's just that our... I guess our mother stuffed us up, but she didn't quite stuff this
message.
This boy up.
Yeah,
she just didn't quite do it. So,
so that was partly motivated there.
Yeah, because I've had so much to say, as well as so much to that's been done. You know, not least with our program, Books and Homes.
Yeah. We'll come to that later in the interview.
Yeah, but I've. Yeah. I had to inform readers where my opinions come from.
Yes.
I'm not from the university. I'm not from the school of theory.
Well, that could be debatable in terms of if you're researching or reading widely. And
no, but you still can't find out the real nitty-gritty. You don't know. That's why I included that character, Shalaya.
Yes.
You've got no idea. I had a woman here, a friend who's dealing in educating and paying for kids up in Northland to do courses on computer coding, data mining, etc.
Yeah.
Right? And she said, you and I know how these people live. They don't know how to set up a bank account.
Right.
They don't know how to shop.
Practically.
They barely know how to clean their teeth. They've
been
taught no life skills.
Yeah.
And you can't be a Labour minister.
Yeah.
And you've just been educated at university and and
you've
think
got to
you
see
know
it for
everything.
Yourself.
You've got to know from the inside out.
Yeah.
And then you've got to act with total integrity at all times.
Yes.
And so not to serve yourself.
And that's what people would expect from any elected official or anyone, you know.
Well, yeah, but our elected officials are right from the beginning, and not they're only there to serve themselves. They're only there to glorify themselves. They're only there for the positions of what they perceive as power, but it's a false power.
Yes,
and it only ever lasts as long as the voters decide to keep them in.
What do you see as the real power?
The real power is not doing anything for any,
but for good.
Anything but good.
Yeah.
That's the real power.
And love. You talk about love too.
Always talk about love.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to do things with love.
So
and integrity.
Yeah. So what led you, sort of going in the order of the book, in the frame of the questions, so we'll get to Once We're Warriors. What led you to write Once We're Warriors?
I don't know. I've never been able to answer that because I think I just had a spark of
inspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just Just sat down and did it?
Oh, I didn't sit down and just do it. I needed the advice of... I was too self-conscious. I was trying to...
You got advice from somebody?
My agent at the time, a guy called Chris Else.
Yes.
He said, take your author's voice out of it.
Right, and you wrote it in a...
And then I did it in a stream of consciousness style. And I got that from reading two books.
But it also had a voice too.
Well, I created those voices.
But yeah.
I don't claim credit for myself. I don't think any of us can get there without. We all, as they say, we all ride on the shoulders of giants.
Yes. And so what does that mean?
Well, Hubert Selby Jr., his writing style just...
Came before.
It blew me away when I read it. I read his two books, Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Requiem
for a Dream. Yeah. And it was just astounding.
But just to keep on with Once Were Warriors, because I remember reading the book, but there are some things I didn't know about the book. Like, I always wondered about the title. How did you come up with the title for Once Were Warriors?
Because I knew that what we once gained all of our mana and our honour from was that that was when we were warriors.
Yes.
And that no longer applied.
Right.
And so the same, that same warrior outlook, it just does not fit modern society. And that's what I was trying to say.
And that was back in 1990 or so?
Yeah.
And do you still think that now?
Totally, yeah. And it doesn't matter whether that society is living in Georgia, near Russia, or in St. Petersburg, or Glasgow, or Liverpool, or Detroit.
Yes.
It's the same mentality.
Right.
It's a dumb mentality.
Yeah.
It used to work. Of course, if you live in a ghetto in anywhere in the world,
it's handy.
It's handy.
Yeah.
Because you have to survive.
Yeah, and that's how you survived in some.
Yeah, I did survive. Yes, I survived.
Yeah.
But what's given me my greatest survival tool is
reading. Yeah.
And that warrior stuff.
Yeah, so reading is powerful.
I think it's everything, really.
Yeah. And so to this day, you read a lot?
Yeah.
Everything or just...
Everything. Yeah. And I reread. Yeah. I reread all the authors that are way superior to me. And I don't have an issue with them being better than me at all.
It is, yeah. So you see something that is... written in a way that is good, and you think, oh, that's good, but you don't have to, have a race to compare.
No, you don't compare.
So you find that you can be happy for other people's success?
Of course, I've always been like that.
Yeah.
With everybody, with everything. I don't care. I don't care if you just walked in and said you just won 100 million in the lotto.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give you a big hug and be happy for you, and I'm not going to ask you for money, I'm just happy for you.
Yeah.
And that's
would you say that's part of being Maori?
No,
or is that
I know.
Part of being you?
No, it's part of being me.
Yeah.
I've met quite a few pretty jealous Maori.
Yeah.
Including people that I grew up with.
You know,
when I became well known, and I go back thinking that they're going to embrace me and they don't want to know me.
Yeah.
So it's not a Maori thing. Of course, it kills you, but
yeah.
But yet somebody else just sent me something. He said, I'm so-and-so, the son of this guy.
Okay.
And he mentioned that he knows you. And I said, yes, he was my hero.
Yeah.
Growing up.
A writer or a friend?
No, he's a friend.
Yeah,
but he was
friend.
A physical man. But
cool, right.
I grew up in that physical world.
Yeah.
And he was at the top of the
You mean physical,
chain.
Like fighting?
Fighting, yeah. But I loved him.
Yeah.
Because he was a good guy, he was good to me.
Yes.
So... But, it's really silly when you think that I admired a man who could fight, really, because what's he achieved?
Yeah, but you admired strength, maybe.
I've got that in me, that warrior in me, but what do you achieve when you're a warrior? You only win the physical battle with an individual. Well, we've given books over the years to 2 million children.
Yes.
Well, wow. That's that's what you call winning the battle.
Yes.
That's a real victory.
Yeah.
So...
Because you do talk about, I think it's Beth in Once Were Warriors, and you do mention this in your latest book, Conversation with My Country. She's looking around her home, and she's saying, where are all the books?
Yeah.
So that was obviously something you felt really, really strongly about.
And I had no idea I was subconsciously laying out something for me that I would start only 3 years after the book was published.
Duffy Books and Homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't, but I knew that that was a significant factor, and I thought, how am I going to do this? I know how I can do it. Have Beth sitting there, and she's just drinking a bottle of beer. But she's watching her soap, sees the bookshelves.
Yeah, is empty.
No, she's got no bookshelves. Sees the bookshelves on the soap opera the that she's watching.
Yeah.
Because they're big American houses with books and, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she goes, my God, and she gets up and she goes from room to room. And that was also a means of me able to take the reader into the bedrooms.
Yeah.
So I had one son, he had posters of boxes on his wall and the different things I was able to...
Yeah.
And then she finds a Penthouse magazine, right?
Right, oh yeah.
And then she sees women with spread legs. But and I thought, fuck it, I can show her.
Yeah.
She's got a sexual side to her. She sees this thing and it's erotic.
Yeah.
And she stirs,
Yeah.
So... But the main point, of course, was she was saying, I'm bookless.
Yeah.
We are bookless. We're a bookless society and none of us are going anywhere.
Yeah.
That's one of the keys to the whole
of
everything.
Do you think, just still on conversation with my country, with the arrival of Europeans, what do you think the effect of, as you say, enforced cultural change had on the Māori psyche? Do you think Pākehā decimated Māori culture when they arrived?
Yeah,
right.
They did.
And so that's had an effect?
It's had a profound effect.
Yeah.
The land theft has had a huge effect. I think their story not being told has been one of the biggest...
In history?
I've been studying the history of Polynesians and therefore Māoris coming to New Zealand.
Yes.
They had been navigating and discovering around a 16 million square kilometre area of the Pacific.
Something to be proud of.
Yeah, and it was never told.
No.
We learnt about bloody Egyptian pyramids.
Yeah.
We learnt about... the Greek philosophers,
yes.
Socrates and Aristotle.
Plato.
And we learned about, of course, British kings and British knights and their gallant knights
and
killing the enemy.
Yeah.
Well, no, we learned about Scottish as well.
You have some Scottish roots.
Yeah. Scottish and Irish. But nothing was ever told of the Māori story. So, yes, it did have... a crushing effect.
Yeah.
But I'm still saying now, I don't resile from saying, I know it had an effect. Well, we better start getting over it.
Yeah.
Get over it.
Move forward.
Yep.
Yeah.
If you've been raped, I'm very, very sorry. If you're my own daughter, you've been raped.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry, but if you're going to allow it to define your life, you just made a terrible mistake.
Yes.
That's the worst thing.
So you're saying one needs to rise up and move?
We've got to overcome everything that happens to us.
Yeah, I do. We will talk a bit about that too, and how that can happen, because I think some people may need a bit of, a help to... it might be hard for some people to do it themselves. They might need a bit,
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, still on a little bit about Once Were Warriors, because you do talk about it a bit at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
So there is a lead character called Jack the Mouse. So, and he is Beth's husband. Why does he go on welfare in the book?
Because he only got $17 a week less.
Yeah.
On welfare than what he did working.
Yeah. Is this?
So I was saying the system of rewarding them for being on welfare is wrong.
Yeah.
And that was back then.
Yeah.
And then, it's only got worse.
So it's almost, you could think of it as being a slightly prophetic that you have painted all those scenes and...
I think if you went back to Once the Warriors, one day they will.
Yeah.
They said, probably won't in my time, but...
Yeah.
If they go back, they'll find out how prophetic an awful lot of things I had.
But it was it's prophetic, I think, as a prophet, say, is you're just describing the time in a way. Are you describing that the time in the early 90s, or is it a previous time, or...?
Oh, no, I'm describing in the early 90s when this welfare thing was really got underway.
Yeah.
But I'm like I did with Beth walking around realising she came from a book to society.
Yeah.
I think...
But they're hard truths to, face. If you can't change it, you might not have the ability to...
Then you go to the people like me who are capable of changing it.
So
I'm not saying that everybody has got that. I was born with something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but...
So with Jack the Mouse, do you have compassion for him?
Totally.
Yes, you do. Because that might be important to have a level of compassion if you're writing about someone who with the violence.
Well...
Because he talked about him being a man who doesn't know what he doesn't know.
He doesn't know what he doesn't know, and so he's not to blame. He's not anywhere near as much to blame as the CEO of Fonterra.
Right.
You know, who consciously took and accepted these outrageous sums of money.
Yeah.
Who then made sure his contract ensured he got a bonus as a reward for leaving. With leaving behind a $660 million loss.
Yes.
He is worse than 1,000 Jake the Musses.
Yes.
He has a
big effect on the farmers.
Well, of course he does, because he has an effect on the entire economy, but he doesn't give a shit. He only cares about himself. But he knows that he's doing it.
Yeah.
Jake doesn't know.
No,
he's never known. No. Jake just goes, hey, shut up. Shut up, bitch.
Yeah.
And she doesn't shut up. He punches her. What's he growing
up
with?
He doesn't know. Like I said, he doesn't know what he doesn't know.
None of us do. If you, me and Joanna walk into a restaurant and I have never been taught how to use a knife and fork, let alone a table napkin, and I pick up the table napkin and blow my nose in it, and I don't know, I don't know.
Yeah. So what do you think the time... The world at the time, and Once We Warriors was released, 1990, I think?
Yeah.
What was the world like for Māori then?
It was a lot worse than what it is now.
Yeah.
But there were no drug problems when I wrote it.
Just alcohol?
Alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There wasn't a...
No, because in the 70s, 70s and 80s dope started to...
Yeah, marijuana.
Yeah, but, everyone would smoke a joint.
Yeah.
After a game of rugby, you know, but the culture was still beer,
Yeah.
Yeah, and jugs of bourbon and coke.
And now it's...
pee.
Yeah, and that's a tragedy.
Absolute tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You say in the book, Conversation with My Country, which is the inspiration for this interview, you say Māori should be fixing Māori problems.
Yes.
Makes sense. But what do you say to people who want to interfere with that process?
It's a hard question to answer, really. I don't like interference.
What do you mean then?
I don't want...
What does it mean Māori should be fixing Māori problems?
Well, they are problems. They're not Pākehā problems. They're not Chinese.
Yeah.
They're our problems.
Yeah.
So we should be fixing them.
Yeah.
You can't have some white man, it's coming in on a white horse to save us. It's no different to teaching us history at school.
Yes.
With the gallant knights going to battle and, going on the crusades and killing all these awful, horrible Muslims.
Yeah.
You know. you just can't have it. You just got to say, no, we've got problems and we have to sort it.
Right.
It does worry me that...
Can people come together?
They're coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're different.
What do you mean?
Māori are different. Yeah. They think differently.
Right.
And so that's got to be recognised.
So they how do could think you could you paint a picture of that? How
they've got a different view, worldview. Right. Entirely different worldview. Yeah. I don't say that I have that worldview, but I certainly have some of it.
Yeah. So what would that worldview look like?
Well, they look at it. They look at the world through more emotional and spiritual eyes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
physical.
No,
they actually look at the world through three different ways.
Right.
Physical. We mustn't forget the physical. They see the world in physical terms. Emotional and spiritual.
How do you think, say, Pākehā would see the in contrast?
I think Pākehā are less emotional.
Right.
They're a lot less physical.
Yeah.
Not all, of course.
What do you mean by less physical?
Well, we will use the fist.
Yeah, movement and dance as well.
But you've got to understand the we live in a world of physicality.
Yes.
It's bodily contact. Yeah. That's why we love sport, you know. Yeah. We like all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, good.
That's why we fight. That's why we're always up in the thing for bashing people, because that's the world view that we have, and that's got to change. That's from once were warriors. It's over.
So just to take it to a positive, you know, instead of focusing on negative things, which can be, you can see that sometimes. What to you is the gift or gifts of Māori culture to Aotearoa New Zealand, and even let's say with the success of Māori on the world stage, did the gifts of Māori culture to the world and Aotearoa New Zealand?
I don't believe that it's Māori culture. I think it's the Māori personality.
Right.
And I think
that the person.
Personality.
Yeah, the personality. So
yep. So it's the every race has got a personality. Scottish are known to be a bit dour, and you know, and the English are a little bit like they think they're born to rule, and you know, and so on and so on. The Germans have been like that, you know. Yeah. They think they're born to rule and they're superior.
Yeah,
we've all got racial profiles.
Yes,
and I think our profile is we are talented.
Mm-hmm.
We are talented. But we don't know it. So
you
know what our culture is? It's discouraging. We should be encouraging and nurturing.
Have more all that
innate talent.
But do you think that may be society needs to make some changes to facilitate that?
No, facilitate themselves. Stop being crybabies. You know,
okay.
We can't be crybabies all the time and say, well, it won't happen unless society facilitates it.
Yeah, okay.
Fuck it.
I don't think they said that. I just asked the question.
No, but it's just me getting passionate, and, because it's...
But, okay. So you're saying the gift of Māori is the Māori personality.
Yeah.
Wow, the first print run of Once Were Warriors sold out, and it sold many times over. What do you think made this book so popular?
I guess I spoke about things that hadn't been spoken about before.
Yeah.
I would like to think that the style it was written in, but unfortunately I no longer believe that.
Why?
I don't think they've got it.
Really?
No.
You don't think that is it a vernacular, or would you you don't think no, that the, it was the, a really like...
The narrative shifts, all the different techniques I used. They were quite totally original.
Yes.
And in this country, in this country's literature.
What was the literary landscape like when you released it?
Oh, it was pretty left. It's always been left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you talk about Hubert?
Selby Jr.
What you are, you would just describe yourself as a self-taught writer?
Well, I guess I self-taught myself. No, I describe
myself. You didn't study it anywhere?
No. I describe myself as genetically lucky.
Right. How did you learn that?
Because my grandfather was a writer.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was a writer.
Yeah.
So, and my dad could write beautiful letters.
Right.
It was in the family.
That's maybe a lost art form now.
No, writing isn't though.
No, but the
writing letters.
But I suppose you can do it with Anna. You talk about writing on behalf of Māori people who had no voice.
Yeah.
What is it that you most want to get across about Māori in conversation with my country?
That we've got so much potential and we've got to turn...
Like Grace in Once We're Warriors?
And that's obsessed me the whole time.
Yeah.
Grace.
She the potential was that she didn't realise...
She read in a magazine that everyone is entitled to fulfil their potential.
Yeah.
And she thought, well, here I am, I'm up a tree and I'm about to take my own life.
Yeah.
So...
Do you think that there are... Well, you talk about Charlotte and we're going to get to her in a bit, but I might ask the question now is, do you think there are, with the suicide rates going up, do you think there is an element of all stripes across all society, not just Māori, and... Do you think that there is an element of people falling through the cracks and they are committing suicide, like the Graces or people when in abuse situations?
I think there's been a lot of talk, probably too much talk on the suicide and the depression, quite frankly.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay.
And if we... I've got virtually nothing to say about suicide.
Yeah.
Because nobody has the answers to it.
No.
People are taking their lives in greater number. My mate was teaching up at a high school up north.
Over 600 this year, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is way more than the road toll.
Mm.
And yet we've got police out with speed cameras and police with their bloody whirring lights, all wanting to, try to bring the road toll down.
Yeah.
And yet where they should be out there in the communities.
Yeah.
Presenting a friendly, accessible face
to
the public.
Yeah.
To say, hey, we're here. Yeah. Your local constable, Mr. Hugh Baker.
Yeah.
Well, if you want a hug, I'll give you a hug.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. It's what we've been doing at Books and Homes for 25 years.
I think there'd be a certain element of people who wouldn't get that vibe from the police.
And of course they've got, because they're too stupid.
Yeah.
The police are stupid. They concentrate on the fucking, on the speed that people are going on the roads. It's just bullshit.
They should be in the community.
They should be in the community and going to the schools and finding out which girls have been sexually abused. And as I said in conversation
with my country, the Charlotte situation.
Knock on the door of the person and say, we know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And we're going to get you. Yeah. Just try every tactic that they can think of to flush them out.
Yes.
That's what they should be doing.
Yeah.
Makes me mad to think.
So maybe then we should talk a bit about Charlotte.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a bit about Charlotte?
Well,
you don't have to tell me, because I know you have fictionalised the name.
I've fictionalised the name, and so let's keep her fictionalised. But
yes.
She's all too common. Anyone can YouTube. I'll give you a perfect example. You can YouTube gang girls.
Yeah.
And you'll see and hear these women so strong, and they're telling about this awful abuse that they suffered.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even a hard nuts like me, I just cry for them because it's like they had no chance.
So why are you writing about Charlotte?
Because they're out there in their thousands.
And you're saying that police, people,
they are way,
leaders in the community...
There's way more than there is LGBT community. There's way more abuse victims.
I mean, they focus on the childhood poverty, but I think really this child is in poverty too. And you're really showing the picture. I mean, What do you think it says about society, and I'm not talking specifically about Māori, but all society, that there are chalets out there?
It doesn't say anything about the rest of society. We can't be...
Really?
We can't be asking how much blame that we yeah. living in this house, you living in your house, how much are you to blame for a chalet out there? You're not to blame in yeah. any shape or form
right.
her being raped when she was 8. If anyone is to blame, it's the police for sitting outside the school giving the teacher a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt rather than going yeah. and asking the teachers, what have you been dealing with? How's your day been? How's your day been, Mrs. Smith? Well, you know what? I got attacked by a kid whose dad is in the mongrel mob.
Yeah.
He spat in my face. He punched me in the face. Look at my eye all swollen.
Yeah.
I got to deal with a kid, and I can.
So this is like Shaila's teacher you could be talking about.
I know. I'm talking about the. Yeah. So we should be the policemen should be talking to the teachers and saying, who are you dealing with at school?
Yeah.
They'll tell them, there are chalets in every single school country.
What's the world like for chalet?
Oh, it's absolutely shot. It's gone.
Yeah.
And I'm not one who thinks your life is ruined, but except your life is ruined
when you're
raped at age 8.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't even say to her till you do something about it. I would never dare say it.
No,
because it's so yeah. unthinkable.
But she, for her, I'm saying, maybe would need to acknowledge in her mind and then, you know, try and... Because like you say about Jake, he doesn't know what he doesn't know. Chalet doesn't know what she doesn't know.
But the one thing that she does know is that she was raped.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that puts her mind out yeah. forever. Because how does she come to terms with it? Because she was raped on a regular basis, she was yeah. passed from house to house. And they are...
It's a hopeless situation.
It's a hopeless situation. But you can go and get these people.
Yes.
Get them and lock them up.
How many chalets are there out there? You said tens of thousands? 100,000?
Yeah. No, not 100,000, but there's tens of thousands. I went to Christchurch Women's Prison not so long ago, and yeah. they said it's full of chalets.
Yeah.
Every single woman that's in there has been... the victim of
rape. It's almost like you're being punished for being raped in a sense.
Yeah, you're being punished for being raped because when you're being
raped in prison. Yeah.
When you're being raped at that age,
mm.
what the fuck? Well, where are you gonna end up? You know, yeah. that's where they're gonna end up. That's why it's such a horrific crime to inflict.
But do you think that maybe some society maybe has a duty to you know, to understand that these things are happening?
No, I think each society has got a duty to itself,
yeah.
to heal and cure itself.
You talk about not just poverty of the pocket, but poverty of the spirit.
Yeah.
I think about some people, when we're talking about people, chalets, who have had very abusive situations.
I didn't mean her, though, of course.
Yeah. They need, do you think that, would you agree, they need tools of empowerment?
No, you can't give the chalet as the tools of empowerment.
Right.
You can't.
But what can we give them?
The ones who I think have got poverty of the spirit, you can just give them messages, non-stop messages to say, hey, yeah. go and, you know, if you...
Positive messages.
Well, if you quite frankly, if you go anywhere on a Saturday night and you see who's working and who's drinking,
mm-hmm.
it's actually the Kiwis that are, we're drinking, the yeah. Asians are working.
Yeah.
In their restaurants or at their businesses.
Yeah.
We've got to take a page from them.
Yeah.
We've got to say,
yeah.
hey, the only way out of this situation is to work your way out of it.
Yeah.
So.
Moving away from the chalet situation now, you gave a talk in the 90s at Waikato Uni. I think it was around the release of Once Were Warriors Time. And you said, I felt as Māori as they did, but that I didn't have to be their definition of Māori. Could you talk a bit about the meaning of being your like, what it's like to be your definition of Māori? I mean, in a world that these days likes categories, I mean, what is your definition?
Well, I think it's about, and I don't mean your question is the thing, but the general question is, what is your definition of Māori?
Yeah.
It's as stupid a question as asking a Pākehā, what does it mean to be Pākehā? They don't know. We're all different.
Well, that's, but you were saying, like, do you think that the people in the uni who I think were, maybe you were coming up against some difficulty there?
Well, I came up against the difficulty of the equivalent of religious fundamentalism. Yes. That's what I came up against.
Right.
They were saying, who gave you the mandate? Fucking mandate? What do I care?
So how does that relate to the... Because as you said, I felt as Māori as they did, but that I didn't have to be their definition of Māori. So
why can't I be my own definition?
Yeah.
I don't even owe them an explanation of my definition.
No.
I just say, I know what I am.
Yes. Right.
End of story.
Yeah.
And I owe you no explanation. That's apologising for your personality.
Yeah.
Well, why would I do that?
There's a lot of talk of white privilege.
Yeah.
Do you believe white privilege exists?
Yeah.
Do you think white New Zealanders are, say, they're not woke to their privilege? Do you think white New Zealand Pākehā?
I don't like that word, woke.
Okay, you don't like that word?
No, I don't. No.
Sorry, I just thought I'd put it in there.
That's okay.
It's word du jour at the moment.
I know, and it's not my thing. I'm a very basic person, and
are
I
you?
Don't know about woke.
Basic?
Yeah, well, I keep saying this. I don't know why, but I'm probably a little bit more complex than that, but...
I'd say so. Okay, let's put it another way. Do you think Pākehā are aware of their privilege? Do you think they're becoming?
No, I think they're aware of their privilege. I mean, it's not just Pākehā. I just think anybody who's in the middle class.
But it's all over the place. White privilege.
Yeah, but it's all bullshit. I'm not buying into that.
Okay.
It's, you know why? Because it's white privilege, and they call it. It's really white guilt.
Yeah.
They're just trying to hit them over the head with the hammer of white guilt.
Yeah, make them white people feel guilty.
But my middle class Māori relations and my middle class Māori mates live the same privileged life. Winston Peters lives the same privileged life. So does Willie Jackson. So does Calvin Davis now.
Yeah.
You know, they're all on salaries of $250,000 a year.
Yeah.
What the hell? That's privilege, isn't it? I wouldn't mind $250,000 a year, but I feel privileged.
Okay. So you think that maybe the white privilege... Do you hear it?
It's just a clarion call that's gone up, and it'll die as, you know.
Yeah.
And another one will take its place.
You took Māori at the margins. You talk about that. How does that look now as opposed to when you wrote Once We're Warriors?
I think it looks better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a whole lot better, but there's still an awful lot of us at the margins.
Yeah, too many.
Yeah, too many.
But
that's what I've spent the last 25 years doing, is dealing with those Māori, their children, at the margins.
Yeah.
That's what I've spent 25 years doing.
Okay.
Touring schools and giving them the messages about love, about aspiring, about never being discouraging to your peers.
Yes.
If somebody tells you they've got a big dream, get around them. And those sort of messages. I've been trying to do something about it in that positive way.
Do you think... you talk about how Calvin Davis and Winston Peters in Parliament. Parliament is perhaps, some would say, more representative of society at the moment, with diversity of race. In America, with the election of Barack Obama, I think people thought there was a post-racial moment. And then they elected Donald Trump, who some could be said that he campaigned on blatant racist slogans. I mean, do you see something like that ever being able to happen in New Zealand? Like someone to come out and, you know...
I'd like to think better of New Zealand. I think Kiwis are pretty good people.
Yeah.
Yes, they were. White New Zealand was guilty of being racist and ignorant in the past. There's no question about that. We all know that.
Yeah.
But I think those same people now, or somebody has, of the white populace, has bent over backwards to try and make amends, and they still are.
Yeah.
So I think that's...
We're not in danger?
No one can say that. No one can predict the future.
Right.
Especially in these uncertain times, because there's a group of people that have been empowered that's never happened in history before.
Yeah.
All the troll, nobody types
yeah.
have got power. Yeah. And it's not only that, it's anonymous.
Yeah.
They can hide behind it, and they can go on social media. They can destroy literally people's lives. They can, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't say never, but well, I think we're pretty good in this country.
You mentioned when you were at school on having to say how much Māori blood you had in a measure of 16ths.
Yeah, terrible.
And yeah, so I did ask you, I think, about the definition of Māori, but can I ask then, I won't ask about it in that sense, what was your perception of yourself in relation to having to do that?
I wasn't really aware what I was, I don't think.
Yeah.
I knew that we had Māori, because obviously we
had... But, you know, in general, how you saw yourself?
No, it wasn't important back then.
Yeah.
No, I got a fright when I was walking up the footpath with my mates, the Chamber twins, and then the
yeah.
mother stepped out and she said, "Go home, you're not welcome here."
To you?
Yeah.
Right, why?
I figured because I was a Maori, she might have even said, well...
Yeah, yeah.
She might have even said that to me, but...
So what do you think is the effect on these... So that you go around the schools and on children's outlook on life, if they are... you know, in a lower class, lower income is possibly a bit nicer. I mean, what do you think the child's outlook is if they're in what is described as a lower class?
Well, their outlook is pretty limited and restricted by almost invariably uneducated parents who are not. They're not telling them go and get a job as an electrical engineer or go yeah. and get a job at go to university. No one's ever telling them that.
Yeah. So they've got a more restrictive view on what they can do.
Not until we came along
yeah.
with Duffy Books and Homes.
Right.
We just said to them, you can be anything you want.
So what is the challenge Māori face in today's world?
Getting over their stubbornness
yeah.
and just damn all. Looking in to see that their house, some part of their house is on fire.
What do you mean by
that? Well, there's an old saying where, you know, you can't even see your own house is on fire. You just turn your back and then it...
Blows up?
Yeah, well, no, just you turn your back and so it just burns down. And they think turning their back on it and not addressing it...
The issue?
To put out the fire. That's what it means. If your house is on fire, put out the fucking fire before it burns the whole house.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of our biggest problems. We've got to get through the stubbornness of our older leadership, in particular. They're just...
So what's wrong with the house? It's on fire. Why is the house on fire?
Well, it's on fire because we've got social problems. We've got incarceration problems. We've got unemployment problems. We've got health problems. That's a house on fire. It's going to all completely burn down if we don't fucking will do something about it. If we blame our obesity on other people, on the system,
yeah,
then we're stuck. It, yeah.
You right. said in Once for Warriors, if you kill a dog all its life, is it any wonder it turns out vicious?
Yeah.
When I read that in your book, Conversation with My Country, your latest book, I thought of Anthony Dixon. How do you think corrections and people who work in these facilities, I mean, people of all stripes, what is there to do?
Anthony Dixon, I don't know. Quite frankly, my son defended him, so I can't really.
Yeah, okay, right. I can't comment on
him.
I didn't know that. In terms of, I think he possibly had quite a hard life before it led to the point of what happened in Pōremarema.
Yeah, but you know, he still chopped off the arms of a couple yeah. of women, didn't he? You know,
yeah.
I mean,
right.
I don't. If I've got my nephew's kids here who are 4 and 2, and some person
did that,
assaults them, or tortures them, or sexually attacks them, I'm not going to go, oh no, it's okay, bro, you had a hard life.
Yeah.
They're going to have to pick up all of the pieces that he's been chopped.
But you did make the point that if you kill a dog, I'm just talking about the experience that one is having in life as they're growing up.
Yeah, but of course it turns vicious.
Yeah.
Or it turns cowardly. But
yeah.
And I do get that. I do get Malcolm Rewa and these sort of people. He was sodomized by his father.
Yeah.
Well, I'm big on that sexual abuse, how that, of all things that can destroy a child, it's the sexual abuse.
You talk about the welfare drug, turning away to a new path now. What do you mean by that? You talk about the welfare drug in conversation.
Well, it's like they're addicted to it. They're addicted to it like they now feel entitled to it.
Yes.
Where's my welfare?
So like, say a drug addict is addicted to a drug and then they feel like they need the drug every day.
Well, you know something? I'm afraid in a society, they can feel like they need the drug every day.
Yeah.
But there's no room for that in society.
Right.
Because you've just put yourself, you've said to the person on the drugs, has said, all I want is my drug fix every day.
Yeah.
And everyone else has to work.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
So that's an entitlement to say, I don't have to work, but I can get my drug every day.
Yeah.
Or I can be a drug dealer and that's fine because I need to feed myself.
The health system has got to look after me.
Yeah.
But everyone else has to go to work.
Give me my hep C drugs or, yeah.
Yeah.
What sort of voice then do you think we should be listening to change the abuse statistics and eventual outcomes? I think because you were for would-be prison inmates and repeat offenders. What sort of voices?
I gave them a lot of good suggestions, but I don't think they're going to listen.
Right.
I've certainly said that.
Do you think it needs to come from within a government ministry or someone in the community?
I don't think government ministries have ever fixed anything.
Right. What is going to help any young person in life flourish later on? And how do we stop the roadblocks to a good life, good positive life outcomes?
Change the attitude.
Right. How do you do that?
You get organisations like us that are just always sending out positive messages.
Right. So how about we talk a bit about, you have mentioned it, about Duffy Books and Homes.
It was something that had to be done.
Yeah. How long have you been doing Duffy Books and Homes for?
Well, we're celebrating our 25th birthday, but I've been doing it for 26 years. We started the year before that.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I've been doing it for 26 years.
Yeah.
So next Friday, I'm going to be in the bay.
Yeah.
And I'm going back, as I've been doing for the last 26 years, back to the school where it first started.
Yeah.
I always visit the school.
Yeah.
As I've been doing countless times over the years.
So Duffy, the books and homes, it gives books to people you've...
It gives books to children.
Right.
And it's three elemental tenets are freedom of choice.
Yeah.
The child chooses the book,
right,
not us.
Mm-hmm.
Our group has nothing to do with the selection of the book. We go to retired teachers or people who are literacy experts and all that sort of thing. So it's about that, it's about ownership.
Right.
And it's about magic being brand new.
Yeah.
Because they've only ever get second-hand goods. I first started the program and I took second-hand books to them and they...
Wanted new.
They didn't say they wanted new, they just weren't interested in second-hand.
Yeah.
There was nothing to get excited about.
Okay.
So my agent gave me a box of books, brand new books, and I took that.
Yeah.
And they just love it. To them, it was like glowing.
Yes. You know,
the books were glowing.
Moving on, you talked about, you did talk a bit about the fire, and
What?
You had the fire.
The house on fire.
Yeah. I mean, there is, you do, there's lots of successful Māori and people out there, and Pacifica people out there. They're doing great stuff on the world stage, on the New Zealand stage, along across all kinds of things. But how can we stop the over-representation of Māori and Pacifica in negative statistics? What's the issue? What's the issue?
The issue is that culturally that we condone violence.
Yeah.
We think that violence is pretty cool.
Within
our societies.
Yeah.
Pacifica even more so.
Right.
They, you know, you get the slap from your Pacifica mother. There's no question about that. They've got an issue with violence, and so have we. And I think we should give a few more love, a bit more love, and a whole lot more hugs.
Yeah. What do you think is the best way to equality between all races here in New Zealand?
I don't know about equality.
Right. Too politically correct.
Yeah, it's not a question I think about. I don't think about equality.
Okay.
Well, I only think about lifting the sights of brown kids in particular.
Yeah.
Just saying, for God's sake.
You're thinking about how to raise up and have a better life.
To have a better life.
Yeah. Do you think the average poverty goes across, you know, all the racial lines? Do you think the average New Zealander really knows what poverty is like? Do you think they need to know?
They've got no idea, and they do need to know.
Yeah, because you say that that's a responsibility to know?
It's a responsibility. Our system should be telling them what real poverty is.
Because some would say, oh, but we don't have poverty because, you know, there are people that don't. But, that you know, the social housing's, you know, they've got a roof. But, you know, then there's, say, people getting rheumatoid and there's damp houses. And how can people learn, you know? Like, is it the responsibility of the media or the government or the stories that get told? Or?
No, it's the responsibility of the people themselves or the leaders in the community.
Yeah.
And the leaders in the community got to say to them, listen.
Because the chalet situation is a revelation in a way. And it's only known because, you're writing about it, because Charlotte is not going to go out there and say, hey, you know.
No, she can't. That's why I say I represent the voices of the
of
the voiceless. But we've got to be able to say to them, you know, I think you've got to pitch in together for some to buy a pail of paint and some paintbrushes.
Yeah.
And sand and some sandpaper and sand your house and paint it.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just living in these houses that are falling apart, and no one's doing anything. They still sit around on the piss with a keg of beer. What I do point out, and I just say, all of you white people, when I speak to audiences, mostly they're white people, and I say, your ancestors used to live, just remind yourselves of Dickens.
Yeah.
Well, you lived in hovels.
Yeah.
There was open prostitution on the streets.
Yeah.
I also point out to the so-called upper class ones who think they're superior.
Yeah. Do you think there is an excess superiority?
No, I just say your fucking ancestors used to hang working class children for bloody stealing a rabbit from their estates.
Do you think there should be Māori prisons? No.
Under no circumstances.
Okay, so, right.
You know what? Because if there's Māori prisons, then they're going to have Pākehā ones.
Right.
And then the Asians are going to say, well, what about our own? You know,
it's going to trickle out, do you think?
Well, no. We're just divided on racial lines.
Do you think prisons fit in the world?
They do for some people. They have to go to prison.
You say most of the Maori in prison have broken hearts.
Yeah.
But won't admit it. Do you think about a place within this system to acknowledge that, the broken heart? Do you
think I wish they could. That might help them find a bit of closure.
Moana Jackson is someone you quote. Moana says prison should never be the only answer, and neither should it be a place to learn tikanga.
Tikanga, no.
What do you don't think so?
It's either? Not the right place.
What is tikanga?
Tikanga Māori is the practice of being, the cultural practice of being Māori.
Learning
to speak, learning the waiata, learning the taiaha, learning all these cultural things.
Do you think there is a place for that, Sue?
Not in the prison.
Not in the prison.
Why, of all the settings, why would you teach that in prisons?
Right. What would you propose instead?
On a marae, wait till they get out.
Yeah.
But
that, do you think that's maybe a good idea for people to go to the marae after leaving?
Because
you talk about prison.
No, I don't.
When someone leaves prison, they don't have enough money.
Yeah, so they've got to come up with schemes so they can, that gives them the money to enable them to start afresh.
Right, so you talk about changing the narrative. What do you think on media reporting of Māori issues? I mean, do you think that's the right term? I mean, because we don't hear, well, maybe they do say Pākehā issues, but...
They never say Pākehā issues.
Yeah, and
then the headline says Māori upset. That means all of us are upset.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a lot of codswallop. They've never had a headline saying Pākehā are upset at something.
Yeah, right.
And also when a Māori steals money, it's more of a headline than when a Pākehā steals money.
Right, so that's media reporting.
Media, yep.
So what are your thoughts then, what are your thoughts on the history? We talked a bit about the history of Māori navigation by the stars. What are your thoughts on the history being taught in schools?
I'm trying to get a project of me and others writing the book on the nation's first settlers.
So do you think a more balanced retelling of history in school could rewrite the script a bit and change the story for some people?
Not even rewrite the script. The script has never been written. It's just been completely overlooked.
Okay.
And I think it should be told. And I think that would have lifted, had it been told 100 years ago, 70 years ago, whenever, it would have lifted Māori self-esteem considerably, knowing that their story has been acknowledged. Because I've been doing my research on it. I'm doing the tribal history.
You're reading a stack of books.
I'm doing the tribal history of a tribe in the near Rotorua.
Okay. And this is where you're from?
Yep.
Yeah.
And the things I'm discovering are quite incredible.
So we're getting close to the end now.
Yeah.
Back to the conversation. You talk about Pine Block, the place where once were warriors were set, a fictional town, a situation you felt needed to be highlighted at the time. There was some hard-hitting stuff in there, but you're saying now we need to change the conversation. What's the conversation we should be having now?
Well, if you want to put ghettos in, if you want to put people in ghettos, you've got to expect them to be ghettoized.
Right.
Don't put them in ghettos. That's don't give
the
them state houses.
For now?
Yeah.
You in the book is saying there is Māori pride, pride in being Māori. So would you say the sky's the limit for Māori in terms of achievement?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If only they would look up.
Thank you, Alan.
That was writer Alan Duff talking about his latest book, Conversation with My Country. If you would like to re-listen or share online, go to www.maryjanethompson.co.nz. Thompson spelled T-H-O-M-S-O-N. Thank you for listening.